Boris and Biden. Is the special relationship about to blossom in the G7 summit, or is Biden going to tell Boris exactly where to get off on the Northern Ireland Protocol and in public? We look as well at vaccines and patents. There are vaccine billionaires created since the pandemic began. Is it time to let the developing world get on with creating their own vaccines? We look at the crazy idea of partitioning Scotland after the next independence referendum, and at the slightly jollier aspect of desire paths crisscrossing our country. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Johns, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. It's the day of the solar eclipse, which I don't think any of us are going to be able to see. It should be happening round about now.
Yeah.
Kicking out the windy.
Well, it was weird, actually. I was off at the docks having a regular blood test, and I hadn't quite got into my head that it was 11 o'clock midday, because, you know, everything in the sky seems to happen in the middle of the night, you know, so yes. I was kind of got it booked for this evening in my head. And I was kind of coming along thinking, this is really weird because the sun seems to be coming out, but it's not getting any brighter. And just in a minute, I thought, do you see? Lack of attention to detail again, Riddick. So, but anyway, good cycle.
Yes.
So
I'm well, raring to go. If you're into the esoteric, when you add up all the extra podcasts that we've done, Leslie, this is episode number 666.
So spooky. Now, honestly, but seriously, have you sat and done that?
No, I just looked and it was right. It just came up and I was doing it. So I've got a warning to everyone out there.
You didn't sit like a kind of, you know, telephone book counter and them.
It comes up. I'm not that daft.
Just, actually, just it comes letting up our audience episode know that, numbers. Pat. They wouldn't want to think you were that sad, you know.
No, but whatever you do, audience out there, do not play this episode backwards. That's all I've got to say. you might
trigger bad things.
Yeah, trigger bad things. Well, talking about triggering bad things, I believe there's been a bit of a spat between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden, and it was all going so swimmingly, wasn't it, after the G7 agreement on minimum rates of corporation tax?
Yeah, well, this will be the story, I guess, of the day and kind of the rest of the week, because, you know, this is Joe Biden's first, it's the G7 in Cornwall, this is Joe Biden's first trip out, as it were, as president. Boris, apparently they're going to agree an Atlantic Charter modelled on the post-war plan, because, of course, Boris is Winston Churchill reborn, as we well know. And actually, Joe Biden is probably trying to do a bit of a tilt towards being Franklin D. Roosevelt. You know, kind of these two are trying to cast themselves as people who are going to sort of recreate the North Atlantic post-COVID. You know, so there's the blooming ambition. And actually, I should get that tone out of my voice, because, you know, we certainly do need a build up after everything that's happened. But last night I noticed that the Times had got a scoop that apparently the American diplomat to London absolutely bawled out this Brexit minister, David Frost. And my God, was ever a surname more appropriately cast than that, you know, because I don't know if you've seen the tale. But he's just, well, wooden, actually. You know, he's, anyway, many, many people say that Frost is the problem with the ongoing difficulties trying to sort out the Northern Ireland Protocol. He is just utterly inflexible in the whole thing. Anyway, everyone, you know, the Boris team had all hoped that Biden would remember special relationship. And there's a bit of a bullshit bingo thing going around for how quick, you know, whether Biden will actually say the words, or, you know, whether he'll be like the modern 007 and wait to say Bond, James Bond, till halfway through the movie, you know, or not at all. But anyway, there was a big bawling out going on over this Northern Ireland Protocol, with apparently the US guy saying to David Frost that it's the UK that's inflaming tensions for simply not imposing the customs checks on goods that it has signed up to. Apparently, this is going to be raised by Joe Biden in his meeting with Boris Johnson. It's not supposed to be the way it goes. And in public this weekend. And also, in fact, I shouldn't have said a guy. The name is unusual. Yael, but apparently that's a female. Yael also said that if Britain signs up to the EU agricultural standards, and that's the way that's being suggested to get out of the Northern Ireland Protocol problem, that we just agree, you know, that we're going to kind of keep the same standards and then that's it. Britain has been trying to suggest that that would stop the UK from being able to strike a trade deal with the United States. Well, yesterday she said that's rubbish. That signing up to EU agricultural standards would not stop the UK getting a trade deal with the US, because that's how much they value. And we know from what Joe Biden said practically the hour after he was elected, that's how much he rates his, you know, his lineage, Ireland, peace, the Northern Ireland Protocol, and putting that first in a way that Boris Johnson clearly doesn't. So there's a big hole blown in Downing Street's argument right away. And if even a half of this comes to pass, this will be quite an extraordinary sort of reprimand at the same time, you know, as obviously there will be Boris trying to get Joe Biden to sort of laugh and look and cheery and everything. But, you know, nobody will miss the point here that this is the United States on the biggest issue that really should be facing Boris Johnson right now, which is the escalating tension in Northern Ireland, is just saying, get over yourself. Sign this deal, do what you agreed to originally yes. in this deal, and don't use us as an excuse.
Yeah, well, that yeah, exactly. Because and I noticed that Biden this morning was reported he was visiting U.S. bases here. It's making it perfectly clear that this was the U.S. which is going to get involved in foreign affairs again, was not going to take a back seat, wasn't going to bow the knee or take the knee to Putin. And As we've noticed before, and that Joe Biden is extremely strong, as many Irish Americans are across the House, on the Northern Ireland peace agreement, on the Good Friday Belfast agreement. That goes right, cuts right across party lines with Irish Americans. So, yes, I think Boris's bluff may be called on this, and to be called out like that, and to actually have facts put in the face that, oh yeah, we can't have a trade deal with the US if we agree to EU agricultural standards. That is a significant game changer. But you noted there again that it was the UK that signed up to this. I mean, but it just seems to be par for the course, Leslie, doesn't it, these days? That what the UK government and its ministers can do is they can act unlawfully, they can be totally incompetent, they can break not only international but UK laws, and nothing at all happens. Michael Gove yesterday.
Yes, well, this is, I mean, really fair play to Peter Gagan, who many people will know and follow, who's a brilliant investigative journalist based in Scotland, Irish to you listen to him, he's Irish to his core. And he actually had some, I think he told me he was staying with his mum during a bit of time during COVID. And he started to look at some of the contracts that were being issued. This was prior, actually, to the COVID period. And this is significant because this was part of the government's defence over the £5.5 million odd contract mm-hmm. that got given to a company with no particular track record of it. You know, sounds familiar already. And one of the with no tendering process. And so he started to have a look at this, began to put some freedom of information requests in, began to get some stuff back that just didn't match at all, brought it to the Guardian, got a Guardian journalist to help him on it. The two of them put their heads down and worked even further, and then linked up with the Good Law Project, which has been behind some of the successful cases, which Andy Whiteman, Joanna Cherry and other Scots politicians got involved with to try to keep Boris on the right, you know, lawful side of the fence over proroguing Parliament and so on. And so the Good Law Project then crowdfunded and brought the case to court. And hey presto, yesterday, 2 hours before Prime Minister's questions, they got the result. The High Court decided that that Michael Gove, as the Cabinet Office Minister, had broken the law by the way that this contract had been awarded, in a way that would make any reasonable person suspect that favouritism had been at play. So kind of you'd think, right, what timing? And, you know, I'm actually going to listen to Prime Minister's questions with a little bit of extra, you know, waiting for somebody to sock it to Michael Gove via Boris Johnson. And nothing. I mean, Keir Starmer went off on a new kind of policy that Labour have got. about trying to recover pupils' educational standards after COVID, which is kind of, you know, OK, that is definitely it's a serious, important issue that will endure, I quite grant you, long after this little spat is over. But nonetheless, you know, politics is about so many things. And when you've got a moment like this, where it's not just a suggestion anymore, it's not just a suspicion, it's actual hard proven, it's a court judgment. You'd think that anyone with their head screwed on would go, yeah, beauty, and just take that one and run with it. But no, nothing. What a wasted opportunity. And it just left me thinking, am I living now in a total parallel universe here, where you might expect this to actually matter? And I know that lots of people listening to this will just go, do you know, you're so naive that you expect the UK government to do anything to that. And actually, no. Do you know, I will stubbornly keep expecting and have in my mind a framework of how a government ought to operate, because that's how I measure their failure over and over and over again. And the day that you get, personally speaking, the day that I get to, ugh, you know, if he's opening his mouth, he's lying. Fine, I quite see that. But, you know, in terms of trying to persuade people who are still even sitting vaguely near the fence on this one, and actually, not even that, in terms of trying to keep your own trajectory for the kind of standards that you think government should be about, I will be appalled afresh every single time and expect an opposition to do similar or just leave. You know, if that's not what you're for anymore, if it's not for trying to take an event like that that you didn't even bother to put any effort into, you left it to all these essentially voluntary bodies, apart from the Guardian journalist, to do that in their time. And the Good Law Project have another 23 cases like this that they're taking through judicial review. Well, thank God for civic society, because you couldn't say that of the official opposition at Westminster. It's pathetic. And I have to say, the SNP didn't lead off with this, although the point that Ian Blackford was making about vaccines for the developing world was actually probably the next most important thing he possibly could have raised, right? And the other thing is, there's no communication between these camps. So the SNP might well have expected that the Labour would be going on this. So they wouldn't know, you know, you wouldn't know which way that argument was going. But I mean, it's just that the kind of complacency that just looks with Keir Starmer, it's all about choreography, poise, the brill cream back slick, you know, yeah. It's all about having it all under control, as many lawyers do, and not being able to be spontaneous and sort of channel anger that the public are feeling. And give up trying to feel if they see a leader who doesn't even connect with it, doesn't channel it. That's what you're meant to do as leader of the opposition.
Yeah, and the aspect of the matter is that he's not, I mean, he's meant to replace Jeremy Corbyn. And not only the centrists in the Labour Party said, if we'd only had a leader like Keir Starmer, not that lefty like Jeremy Corbyn, we'd be 20 percentage points ahead in the polls. Well, it ain't working. I mean, I genuinely don't know what Keir Starmer's about. Is he actually triangulating so much about for fear of offending people who actually support the Conservative government because it's populism, not because of its policies, but it's populism? Is he so frightened of offending them? He's frightened to attack? He's frightened, or is he totally incapable of doing it? I mean, he was a man who seemed so poised, so assured from the front benches during all the Brexit debates. But again, as you rightly said, Lizzie, these were planned, these were prepared, these were not spontaneous. I mean, and Jeremy Corbyn was pretty ruddy lousy from the front bench, to be perfectly honest as well. I mean, there's none of them actually setting the heather on fire, you know, any of the front. I mean, and God.
And the thing is, that's what people. Either. I think that's what people value. You know, they well, and perhaps overvalue, to be fair. You know, someone who can think on their feet in the moment. And I mean, whatever anybody else thinks about Nicola Sturgeon, that is a great skill she has. Sometimes it's an overrated one, but the ability to think quickly and be articulate. And it's important because, you know, when people don't see their story, see their story being related, or it's as if, you know, an impact has happened against the body politic and then it has had no resonance or sound emitted from it. You know, it's as if it didn't happen. And then that is what utterly, I mean, that's what whole Trumpism was about as well. You know, this constant business of deflecting attention onto something else, big yeah. important things never really reaching, you know, an outcome. And it sort of drives people bonkers. So you just have to have some kind of sense that something happened and it mattered from somebody. And I see, you know, later Angela Rayner was sent out to try and sound annoyed about it. But too late, man. You know, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah. What's PMQs for if it isn't for putting the boot in? And I'm sorry, people will turn and say, well, Pat, that's a bit down market, isn't it? Well, no, that's what it's about. We all know it's a bear pit. And it is that if you're going to have that Oxford University Debating Society set up, that is your ideal opportunity to actually be quick-witted and to make a valid point. And it's a valid point, not just about what happened with Gove and that decision, but the track record of Hancock that we spoke about last week. Priti Patel, who broke the ministerial code, you know, on bullying. And we chucked out the previous government by Theresa May because of her backhanded connections with the Israeli Defence Force. But Priti Patel was found guilty of breaking the ministerial code. Nada. Jenrick, nada. Boris Johnson himself, nothing. You know, it is a track record, and that was the moment on which to tackle them on that track record. And as far as the other comments are going, breaking the ministerial code, Douglas Ross, where's your red card now, Douglas? Because that's what you said should happen, and you've been extremely silent on that. You can't distance yourself from this continually. But Ian Blackford, again, I thought, you know, the vaccinations and the cuts to foreign aid, you know, absolutely appalling. I mean, it's again, breaking the law. It's in current law. It should be 0.7% of our GDP every year. And that's been in there since the 1970, right through Thatcher. We've been punting out, and appropriately, 0.7% of our GDP in terms of foreign aid. And now it's going to be cut. And Blackford was right to focus on it, as were you in your recent article, Leslie, a couple of articles that have kind of gone into this in more depth.
Yeah, well, because, again, Boris is, in anticipation of this G7 summit, trying to sound like, you know, I was going to say Lady Bountiful, but he's not, you know, yeah. Mr. Bountiful, by trying to mitigate the row about the foreign aid budget, which was only sort of averted by the speaker deciding that the amendment that was going to try and restore that cut was out of order. So anyway, he was sort of talking about, yep, the whole world will be vaccinated by the end of 2022, which is right. Let's just get this in English, 2023. Right. And Britain would be sending 100 million jabs abroad. They do jabs. We do jags. Now, this is kind of quite. You know, that sounds as usual, if you don't really look at it too much, that sounds fine, except that by 2023, hundreds of thousands of people will be dead across the world for no reason.
Yeah.
And dangerous variants will have been given the space to develop. Economies will be destroyed. And that's because of, well, OK, a discussion that needs to be had, which is about patents. Now, we actually did another podcast with Mark Blyth, and he's sceptical about whether this would work. But the developing world is not. And the health minister of Malaysia, or indeed Indonesia, told a World Health Organization event last week that his country is ready to go right now to produce 500 million vaccine doses if the patents could be relaxed. As it is, there are 9 vaccine billionaires created since the pandemic began because of the massive amounts of profits that are being made through essentially monopoly products. Now, there is a counter argument, it's the one that Mark Blyth put, that actually the raw materials needed for all of this are limited, and all that would happen, this is what Big Pharma is saying as well, is that there would be a scramble for the raw materials, putting the safety and security of everyone at risk. And also that these new entities would have little or no experience in manufacturing vaccines. Now, this does seem a bit rich coming from Pfizer CEO, because India is one of the biggest producers of vaccines in the world. And of course, obviously, I mean, India and China are no slouches when it comes to being able to pick up ideas and reproduce them extremely accurately and well. So, you know, I'm not sure about this, but I mean, it doesn't matter what I think. the place that this ought to be discussed is the G7, because actually France, Macron backs this idea of asking for the patents to be dropped. So does Joe Biden. And no one's quite sure if that's just posturing in the knowledge that this kind of market intervention won't be possible for other reasons, or whether this could actually happen. But the kind of debate about whether or not it's wise to do, I mean, for God's sake, do G7 leaders, do these guys want on their consciences that they could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives if they had got to a stage where they just blocked profits, essentially, for a limited period? Yeah. To allow the developing world, which is, generally speaking, well capable of doing very many things that lofty sounding CEOs suggest they can. Would you like that on your conscience? And is that worth discussing? Well, it blooming well ought to be. So the G7 ought to be talking about this. Perhaps it will be in the side rooms, but it doesn't seem to be on the main agenda. Although Joe Biden might yet surprise, and Macron might well surprise everyone by picking it up. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ian Blackford made an extremely valid point in his intervention. He said that no one is safe till everyone's safe. I mean, even just in enlightened self-interest, let's exclude, you know, conscience from this. But in terms of enlightened self-interest, you're wanting to get people vaccinated. You're really desperate to get it done. So,
yeah, but if you looking at some of this detail, I mean, the Indian government is saying that it has been in discussion with the Western manufacturers, and the earliest they could even think of delivering vaccines is October.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows what the situation in India is. And then, of course, all the rest of this is they're just in such a desperate situation. So the question is just how best to help. And, you know, OK, is it ramping up with the existing manufacturers? They're saying it's going to take them months to set up factories. Why? You know, these big hospitals that were set up at the beginning were set up in weeks.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just don't buy, personally speaking, any of this. And I would have hoped that if there was a moment for a real focus on how this is all going to work with a sense of urgency, conscience and responsibility for the world. Because here's the next thing. There's 100 developing countries have signed up to wanting this to happen. And there's a suggestion that these guys have got, you know, very little muscle, but they have got one muscle, which is they will not agree to the climate change cuts
right.
that are necessary.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're going to go for this whole world thing, going back to, you know, what was being suggested about this kind of Atlantic, whatever it is, you know, agreement for a new world post the coronavirus, then, you know, you've really got to be taking everyone with you. And what the developing countries want right now is the ability to get on with producing vaccines themselves.
Yeah, and in addition to that, one of the cuts that are going to take place, I mean, is to water projects is getting an 80% cut in UK funding if it moves down to 0.5%. Now, that's sanitation, hygiene. And I mean, in what world does it make sense to cut water aid projects focusing on sanitation and hygiene in the middle of a pandemic, which depends upon poor sanitation and poor hygiene to flourish. You know, so again, back to that. But one of the key things that's been said is that there's popular support for cutting the foreign aid budget. And I just wonder if people actually knew the reality behind it, by what cutting foreign aid would mean in terms of real human beings. You know, and charity begins at home, which I always find interesting, given from people who wouldn't spend a penny on local people. You know, I mean, people like Esther McVeigh, you know, going around saying, oh, we should be spending the money on our own folk, given the fact of the pandemic situation. Well, Esther, who voted against extending free school meals. Esther, who was one of the people in charge of the rollout of universal credit. I all listen to her about charity, and I prefer the word love, because that's Caritas is where that comes from. But one of the key things I looked at was, we're going to be cutting from 154 million to 23 million if this goes ahead to the UN Reproductive Health Agency. Aye, well, what we're doing involved in that. That will mean 7 million unintended pregnancies, 2 million unsafe abortions, and 23,500 maternal deaths predicted if we do that. And I genuinely believe if that's what you put to folk and said, what do you think about foreign aid cuts now? That would make them take a step back and think about it in terms of the reality, because that's what it means. But, you know, it's this populism thing that they're playing the game with. And I don't know if you noticed there seem to be a significant number of UK ministers and Tory politicians banging on about sport recently and removal of portraits of Her Majesty from, it's, I would say Magdalen, but you're apparently meant to say Magdalen College Junior Com. Now, I don't know about you, Leslie, but the Junior Com room I went to, if there'd been a portrait of the Queen up there, what? Pardon?
Well, this is darling, it's Magdalen College in Cambridge and Magdalen College in Oxford. When I was there, not in Magdalen College, but the college I was at, Wadham College, the students renamed the main quad Ho Chi Minh Quad, essentially, to sort of push back in a childish way against the main funders that were actually going into their very privileged education, mind too, who came from Iran. In fact, the Shah of Iran, who built the library. So, there's no good way to say anything about anything that goes on in Oxford, because it is absolutely funded by privilege. But anyway, I interjected Magdalen.
Because what I was thinking was about is that people may think that these interventions by people like Sir Graham Brady talking about England footballers taking the knee, being compared in some quarters, folk might be aware of the fact that England footballers were instructed in the 1930s when they played Germany to actually give the fascist salute, you know, during it. And a Tory MP compared the England footballers taking the knee to giving that Nazi salute, believe it or not. Another one's turned around and said, oh, no, I won't be supporting England in the Euros if, you know, they're going to take the knee. We've had this thing about the Oliver Dowden, the culture secretary, saying, you know, the way the England Cricket Board have treated Ollie Robinson because of racist and sexist tweets, he's been immediately suspended, following their own regulations from Test cricket, while they investigate and undergo their own procedures. And I'm thinking to myself, and I suddenly looked at an article by Matthew D'Ancona, who said, this isn't accidental. You've got this wrong. Since Munira Mirza and Dougie Smith, her husband, have taken over, she's the director of the Number 10 Policy Unit. Now, Munira Mirza is an interesting person. She's one of that group, I remember, the Revolutionary Communist Party, Claire Fox, Brendan O'Neill of Spite, who now seem to have moved over to, have definitely moved over to the right, and are ploughing this populist line. And this is a tactic. It's a strategy. It's even more than that. It's a strategy that they're going to focus on culture wars. They're going to make these the big issues, because that's the populist route. Ignore the policy and let's look at the populism. So you're going to find a lot more of this discussion about, you know, you're going to have Harry and Meghan, should they call their baby Lilibet, the removal of the Rhodes statue, the England footballers taking the knee, etc., etc. And what we've got is a whole range of populism, populist ideology, populist methods being used to secure the popularity, yes, of this current Conservative government and ignoring the policy. I also find it extremely interesting that Gareth Southgate, I mean, who I have a lot of time for in terms of his man management and the ability he's had to take that England team forward, and seems to be a very modern man, he came out with a tremendously interesting statement where he talked about we've all got different definitions of what it is to be English. And he stressed his Englishness was based upon his grandfather, who was a military man and a fierce patriot. And he identified his affinity for the military, his pride in Queen and country, and was attempting, I think, to transfer the occupation of territory by people who are on the right complaining about the taking the knee, and bringing it back in to try and suggest, you know, there is an inclusive society in which you can have an affinity for the military, you can have pride in Queen and country, and still take the knee. And I thought an interesting take on it. I'm not sure how successful it's going to be, because a lot of these folk who are booing the England players for taking the knee, I don't think they're going to be at all impressed by Gareth Southgate, even though he's trying to to occupy that ground, but take it in a more inclusive way forward. So I'll wait and see what happens during the Euros. And I'll also be intrigued to see if the Scottish players, when we play at Wembley, just as a matter of solidarity, even though we don't normally take the knee of the Scotland team, for sounding reasons that they've actually talked about and I can relate to, will they take the knee as in a show of solidarity? And personally speaking, I sincerely hope they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I quite agree with what you're saying, that this is just a strategy of diversion. So these spats I tend to just sort of let go over your head, basically, because they'll be here one day in the front page of the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, gone the next day with another one up there, and then all these other issues just doofed, you know, to one side. I just was thinking recently, I was just sort of wondering what it would be like to live in a country where you could actually feel pride in yes. in something to do with, I don't know, the world. You know, I remember when I was in Norway, people really, really are very attached to their royal family, and there's no ifs or buts about it particularly. You know, they just think they're pretty cool and they don't cost a lot and they've led the country through difficult times in the war, etc. And they don't have that but thing kicking in that most of us that support independence mm. will have. And it's an odd thing, actually, because it's become so normal for us to just have so many buts in our framework of thinking. I've got so many that when I, you know, I don't watch BBC News now because it triggers a but within about 30 seconds. And of course, I mean, a lot of people say, well, you know, if you only discover that now, I quite appreciate that was always embedded in there. It seems to me to have got worse. I don't know if it's because of my own politics changing, but I just can't bear the knowledge that from the first time, it's a bit like bullshit bingo. You know, the first time you hear a couple of these key words, you know that this report is just going to sweep right past the subject, really, right past the way that half of Scotland thinks, you know, and there's no reason they should pick it up, you know, because they're reflecting the bulk of British people, which means the south of England in population terms. But that's what we've grown used to. We've just grown used to listening to something that is just, or switching it off, that's just vaguely kind of a bit like our lives. It's not our lives. It's just like our lives a bit. And actually, if you listen to anybody else's output, you know, NRK and in Norway or you know, Ruv in Iceland, mm-hmm. you'd probably feel as much identification with the news that you were getting there as to what you hear in British news by anybody, except I would say Channel 4, which is the only news I can tolerate, because it tends to lead off with a, you know, here's really important things, and they actually set the agenda with issues very often to do with international news, which is just otherwise completely ignored. But that's almost the sort of marginalized receptacle for folk in England who are still progressive and want some decent kind of news coverage. Otherwise, you have to sit through this wedges of utter rubbish on every channel, you know, now, pretty much, because that is just part of the British way, and worst, actually, in Scotland, where it's strange that when you get somebody that comes in from Firth of the Parish, like there was a wee programme done by BBC Northern Ireland recently. Mm-hmm. They interviewed myself and David Clegg in Dundee. And actually, the most interesting bit in it is David Clegg's contribution, because in it he says to them, you know, that he thinks that the folk, basically unionists and politicians based in London, completely have underestimated the tenacity of independence supporters and the reality of independence within Scottish politics. And it's strange because I don't think he's ever really voiced it quite that way within anything I've heard him doing in Scotland. But when you get somebody coming in and asking you to stand back and have an overview of where things are, it's really clear that the astonishing thing is that despite all the ups and downs and stops and starts and internal arguments and so on, there is still half the population of Scotland very on becoming independent as soon as possible. And actually, quietly on their own, when they're asked by somebody who comes from outside Britain, that's the answer that you have to give to be even halfway honest about it. And yet you just don't get that captured in pretty much anything we see about anything. So I've got to say, I tend to not watch now much of or listen to much of that news.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. The difficulty behind it, though, Leslie, is that I genuinely think that this is a strategy that Number 10 has decided upon, which is to focus on these culture wars, stoke them up, get involved.
Yeah, you know, sure.
Say and do things, and that's the way of it, unfortunately.
But what do you do? I mean, what do you do? I mean, okay, this sounds does sound contradictory, given mm-hmm. that I was suggesting there should have been a bit of a punch up over Michael Gove earlier, right? But you know, the problem is that attention both ways works for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
yes.
People weighing in and arguing with them, it's fine. It's all, as the Buddhists would say, an attachment issue. Where is your energy going?
Yes.
Where is your focus focused on? What are you attached to? And what I'm trying to say is I am sort of trying to detach myself from essentially mm-hmm. a London news agenda now, because it, just as you say, it is simply cranking the wheel and even putting your energies into trying to, you know, kind of come up with some argument about whether somebody should take the knee or not take the knee, or, you know, Lilibet or not Lilibet, or any of this kind of stuff is just it's just seems to suck your energy away, you know, in a way that. Yeah. Yeah, it's just it's exactly what they want. They actually, just back to the old Oscar Wilde thing, you know, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. So as long as that's all that people are talking about, and it actually infantilizes people's brains, you know, so that if this is the digest of what you think important news is,
yes.
it gets very hard to get your brain back onto stuff like, just, you know, coming back to that foreign aid thing, when I was sitting looking through loads of statistics on a really great site whose name I've suddenly forgotten, but we'll put in the notes, according to Bloomberg, who are the, you know, real financial experts in terms of news agencies, Brexit will cost British citizens £200 billion by the end of this year. £200 billion lost on Brexit. The uncut foreign aid budget was $14.5 billion.
Yeah.
Right. So it's all a question of perspectives, and as long as we're just dealing with these small kind of tabloid things, which I'll grant you, it's like the clickbait on the Daily Mail thing. If you ever go on that site, which generally speaking I avoid, because your eye cannot stop. You know, before you know what you've done, you've almost clicked on it. So it works. If it didn't work, they wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, well, you've got, because one of the statistics I came up with, again, it's just that it leads me to it. It's not as eye-watering as the cost of Brexit, but to use Boris Johnson's own phrase, we've spaffed $37 billion up against the wall on this total failure of a track and trace system led by Dido Harding, who was praised by Man Hack this morning. And I'm sure we'll be talking about his appearance in front of the Joint Select Committee next week. And that works out at nearly 40% of the total English NHS budget on salaries. Oh, sorry,
wow.
Total NHS budget, sorry, nearly 40% of it. And, you know, and you're saying to yourself, yeah, well, we'll just let that go by. But see that Ollie Robinson, he was only 18 years old when he tweeted racist and sexist stuff. And, you know, we've got him, but take the knee. Nah, move on. But, yes, you're talking about David Clegg, of course, comes from, a partitioned part of one island. And I wasn't sure how to take this, because your video column on Andrew Wood, I wasn't sure whether to go, load of old nonsense, Andrew, who's suggesting that there might be a partition of Scotland after a second independence referendum that said yes, and those areas of Scotland which had voted no would remain in the UK. Is it load of utter nonsense, or is he just floating an idea that somebody somewhere at Number 10 might pick up on? And by the way, if it worked that way, we had Dundee, Glasgow, etc., would have been the independent Scottish republics by now, which was an interesting little thought that I thought, oh, well, why didn't you offer that one in 2014, pal?
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And possibly joined by Liverpool.
Yes.
You know, if they'd been able to have a vote, since, you know, a sort of straw poll, a proper poll, actually, in 2015 found that 75% of Liverpudlians would want to come with Scotland if we went for it again. And this is, you know, there's many points you could make about this. You know, I did a wee video column about it. But it's kind of, it does totally ignore the idea of being a nation. And mm-hmm. this is kind of classic Tory stuff, in that there is no organic kind of entity in life, there is no society. It's not an organic thing either. There is just money and bits of things and numbers. You know, we're just all randoms. There's nothing, there's no work. And the thing that, God, makes me switch off the second I hear it is anyone starting a piece saying that, you know, the hopes of the nation. There is no single nation in Britain. It is a state. There are four nations. So, you know, that's a difficulty to start off with. That you know, what we're hearing all the time is that the nation is being conflated with the state. So anyway, meanwhile, back at the fort, in the brains of most Scots who understand these things, Scotland is a nation. And it has there's so many ways that is demonstrated. Obviously, Brexit was the easiest one because we counted the numbers that time. And without a clipboard at telling people how to vote, everyone just spontaneously voted to stay within Europe because that was kind of what the national outlook about Scotland is. Even the south of Scotland, even Orkney and Shetland, everyone had a similar kind of idea about that. And, you would wonder whether if people who live in the south of Scotland are really totally keen to actually embark on a new life as English people, for whom no public water supply will be available, for whom they will not any longer have publicly run health boards even, because, you know, they're still being run by private companies and that is still going apace. All of the stuff that you just don't pay much attention to because you think that's normal, it's not normal, yes, south of the border. So beware what you wish for. You're being at the moment shielded because at the moment the sort of urge to push back against, well, this is the next bit, justifiably actually sometimes, against an over-centralised Scotland is being confused a bit with what the nation of Scotland gives. And what it gives is a commitment to public services, which it's rightly given pelters on when it isn't living up to those standards. And it has resisted the privatisation agenda south of the border so much that none of us even realise what it would be like if you just walked so far in the other direction. But, you know, if you look at kind of international precedent, and I did sort of wonder about this, there have been, I mean, the island cluster of the Åland Islands, which is sitting in the Baltic Sea between Finland and Sweden, it would almost stretch pretty much from the old capital of Turku in Finland to Stockholm. It's part of that same sort of geological feature. Anyway, these guys, after Finland became independent after the Russian Revolution, these folk who all spoke Swedish because they were that much essentially closer to Sweden, they really wanted to join Sweden. You know, if it's all kind of everything's up in the air, we just want to hightail it and be part of Sweden. So actually both Finland and Sweden agreed that the problem should not be solved by anybody doing stampy footy on either side of the Baltic. They gave the problem to the League of Nations, which sadly exists no more, but in some respects has been taken over by other institutions. And the League of Nations thought about it, listened to evidence and decided, it took 4 years to decide this, that Åland should stay as Finnish property. However, the Finnish government people should pay for the Ålanders to continue to learn in Swedish, speak Swedish. Everything should be available in two languages. Furthermore, the Åland Islands should remain permanently demilitarized so there'd never be any fights about it on the Åland Islands. And they should get a special sort of status, a bit like Jersey, where every cruise ship that was moving around the area between with Sweden and Finland involved would have to dock at Mariehamn, which is the largest port on the Åland Islands, which is some dancer of a way to kind of get, you know, duties for tying up and all the rest of it. Nowadays, the ships are able to bypass Mariehamn, but only if they pay a bung, basically, to the Åland Islands. So the Åland Islands have, I mean, we really wanted to get their essentially prime minister, although they're just one large comuna. But anyway, there's only about 40,000 people or whatever. We wanted to get them over for a Nordic Horizon event, and we just never managed to quite get them. So they're very interesting, but they're Finnish. You know, at the end of the day, the point about it is that they were able to take a moment and try to kind of get a better deal for themselves. And by gum, they did. But they remained within Finland because that was part of the geopolitics of the area. Now, Orkney and Shetland, and in fact, every area in Scotland would be quite justified in trying to get a better deal for themselves in a very centralised country, perhaps the most centralised in Europe, and that's Scotland, not just Britain, Scotland, when there is the kind of, you know, mobility that's created by the creation of a new state. But that doesn't mean anybody wants to dance off. I mean, what would it do for Orkney and Shetland to have all the terminals for their ferry, important ferry connections in another country? So, you know, there's two things going on here. And of course, they get sort of mixed up. There's a bit of truth that these areas want to get a bit of attention. And that is something that is well worth waving in the faces of the Scottish government. But really, the days of protest voting will end pretty rapidly in these areas when there's a choice between two different states.
Yeah. And you're absolutely nail on head, Leslie, when talking to family and friends in England. They look up here at our society and the things that our government has done, the things our government had not done, with envy, the people I speak to who can see through the propaganda. They see the tuition fees situation. They see a National Health Service in particular protected from the not just creeping but overwhelming privatization that's coming down the road. So absolutely, yes, you're talking about the potential for a future Scotland, and we were also talking before we started the podcast about you being out on your bike, Leslie, and following trails. And it's a funny kind of thing. I don't know what you've been like, because I've been out walking more. Have you noticed more these paths that aren't official paths that lead you places? You've got a set of steps going through a park, and just about 20 yards to the right of it, there'll be a trail that's been made by people who've said, no, that's the long way around. The short way around is, So I was, funnily enough, I was talking to my brother-in-law, who's an architect, and I was mentioning this, and he says, paths of desire, or desire paths. And I'm going, yeah, what? And he went, yeah, these are things that switched-on architects have known about for years. J.M. Barrie, believe it or not, called them paths that are made themselves. Well, they've kind of made themselves, but they're made by human beings who are operating with their wishes. They're deciding that I'm not going to go this way, that I'm going to run contrary to design and planning. Now, the funny thing about it was I started to look it up, and there's a group of Aussie academics, Ballard Muller and Joyce, have done, and if I believe it or not, Zita Joyce, Professor Zita Joyce, have done a big academic paper on this. And what they call these desire paths are records of civil disobedience. So what's happened is that smart planners over a period of time have started to design around these desire lines. Even some of them have actually said, oh, we're not going to put any waste paper bins in just now. We're going to wait for a few weeks and see where people drop cigarette butts and cans. Yeah. And that's where we'll put the waste paper bins. We'll wait till people have been walking about here and we can actually put the paths in that actually suit human beings, not what we think they want, but what they actually want. And two examples of this that we've seen, that Broadway apparently follows the Native American pre-colonial trails, and Edinburgh's Cougate are two actual paths of desire that have been incorporated over the years into the urban planning. There's signs of not following the script. There's signs of not following a narrative laid out by authority. We can make our own story and make our own world as well as being in it. So there we have it. And if anybody thinks that's an analogy for the potential of the Yes movement and a potential for a new Scotland that I'm making, yeah, you're right. Because it struck me as that's the way we should be going. And it hits the nail on the head, as you said, from the previous one, which is we're over-centralised, over-control. And what we've got sitting there is we've got a Scottish government, which is doing very good things. We've got the SNP as a political party, which is over-centralised and over-controlling. But we've still got the Yes movement on the outside and everybody beyond that who are out there doing their own things in their own communities. And I know it's hard, but they're setting up organisations. They're setting up co-ops. They're doing fine things in their community. And that's laying out the paths of desire for the future.
That's a really good way of putting it. And actually, just on that, There is a new group, the People United, that's been set up, which is, you'll find that, just Google it, the People United. And that's an attempt to do a lot more international collaboration, collaboration across the British, the islands of Britain, with other people who are trying to kind of raise issues about democracy and make sure that independence works for working class people. That really is at the heart of it. So it's an interesting proposition. Jean Urquhart, my pal that used to run Cayley Place, was actually more famously an MSP for the SNP who left over the NATO vote. She's on the board for it. Many other interesting people are, including folk from other countries and the other parts of the UK. So it's well worth looking out for. And just, you know, finally, when I was thinking about your desire paths, the thing that I kind of notice now, having cycled a lot more around around Fife, basically, is that I now just operate on the basis that if you begin to think about where would there have been paths, mm-hmm. you'll find them.
Yes.
You know, if you think, just your mind starts to get into the path, the topography of past movement. And it's just impossible in the days when people had to donkey along, you know, literally from place to place, that if there's a wee village and a wee village, there is not a way to connect them directly instead of the routes that are taken these days. So if you have a bicycle with some decent, you know, sort of chunky tires on them, and you do tend to sort of look for the beginnings of what has been a path, okay, I'll quite put my hands up and say I have had a lot of dead ends. You know, I've had a lot of carrying the blinking bike. I've had a couple of community payback paths that sort of stopped paying back halfway along and ended up, you know, an absolute nightmare of a thing with nettle stings in the full nine yards. But dem's the breaks when you're trying to find, you know, the old routes, and as well as your analogy of the desire paths with people breaking out and finding their own routes to independence, it's also to pick up the old routes that have always mm-hmm. been there. Within society, because, you know, it, in a sense, it is not natural for small places and groups of people not to connect, you know, especially in Scotland, which to my mind is all about connection. It's, you know, when I notice this when I'm out, especially on the bike, but even that thing people do in cars and everything else where they acknowledge you, especially in country areas when you're going past, it's people speaking to one another yes. when they're going walking past. It's because you can't think you're not connected to the person that's walking past. We're not sitting in complete, you know, kind of isolated vacuums. We are connected and we keep trying to make connection. So, yeah, it's absolutely paths of desire. That's a lovely, lovely kind of thought. And well done to the Joyces for getting there.
Yeah. And on that, I'm just a seemingly cheery note. You know, it's that I'm looking outside. It's still dull. But fingers crossed that the sun is going to break through. And we'll see you next week, Jumps.